Thank you for downloading the Turner Talks program. Turner Talk webinar programs are aired on Tuesdays at noon Central Time. To join a noon Turner Talk webinar, go to rad-cast.com. Programs are eligible for CE credits towards your licensure. CE credits will be awarded to individuals who have opted to redeem course credits via the a la carte option or the RadCast All Access Pass subscription and have completed the program post-test with a passing score. Just as a reminder, track all of your CE credits with the CE wallet on RadCast.com. Here, we'll help you track your credits that you've completed on RadCast and from other providers as well. Have a topic you'd like to see us do our show? Send an email to client.support@radcast.com and let us know what your ideas are because we want to be your education partner. On this episode of Turner Talks, we have Tim Kelly, and he's from a company called Nautilus. And what they do is to ensure that all of those images that we take and send and transfer, that all that gets done in a very safe and effective way. So good morning, Tim. It's cold where I am. I'm not sure exactly what the weather is where you are, but I'm cold this morning. So we're going to get into this conversation, have some fun, you know, talk about some things. But first, I'd like for you to give maybe a bio or a history, a little bit about yourself and a little bit about Nautilus.
Sure. Well, I'm born and raised in Chicagoland, and it is cold here as well. actually warming up, though, so it's kind of nice. I've been in Chicago my whole life and had a healthcare career here, starting in pharmacy benefit management and eventually somehow navigating my way into the radiology world in the late 90s. And I was part of a team that first initiated replacing film with CDs, and it was a mission sale at the time to talk about saving money, saving the planet with getting rid of film and the overall cost of it. And the digital age of medicine was coming on pretty fast, so it was just better medicine at that time too to make sure they're reviewing digital images instead of film on a light box.
Interestingly enough, I'm old enough to remember, you know, them coming to get the big barrels of film so that they could recover the silver. And so interesting that you're right. Interesting time when everything began to switch over.
Yeah.
So you and I have had some conversations, some chats before today, hopefully, that we pull this all off well and organized. And you sent me a really interesting study or a story. It was kind of about an experiment was done on a vehicle, actually, on a Jeep Grand Cherokee. And it talked about how easy it is to hack into the things that we may take for granted or some of the things that we're so familiar with every day. How about you recall that story, because that's going to lead beautifully into us talking about how easy it might be to hack into our medical records.
Sure. That's there's a lot of things out there that people don't even know are on networks or communicating with servers. And one of those things is cars. It's cars get updated, tracked, and a lot of data is brought in from vehicles. A few years back, a group of hackers, they planned a story with Wired Magazine, had the writer go out in his Jeep, and as he was crossing the Golden Gate Bridge, took over his car, the steering, the brakes, played with the radio, turning the wipers on, and then turned the car off, and terrified him because an 18-wheeler was coming up on him, and he said, "Please turn my car back on." And they had to hold that story for a while, because they realized it was such a major security risk. If cars could be taken over, it could be a terrorist act could take place with driving automobiles off the road in mass scale. And so they had to figure out a method of updating cars that could not be breached. And that's utilizing a peer-to-peer technology that was created by Dynetics, a defense contractor. And they gave us that same advice to do that with medical imaging. And so we deployed our platform for moving medical data around. We use a peer-to-peer private key network, just like automobiles.
So I was going to ask you that. What does that Jeep story have to do with medicine? And so you touched on it a little bit, but maybe how did it look when it was hackable maybe, or has it never been hackable? Has it always been done well, even from the early implementations?
No, there most of the companies out there are still using standard type of security, which is an HTTPS upload, download. And I mean, it's fairly secure, but it's definitely not unbreachable. There's breaches all the time. A company lost 450,000 records just a couple of years ago. And the fines are significant. And so it's not just the risk of losing the data, but the financial risk is tremendous. A local hospital here in Chicago lost a laptop and they were fined $7 million for it. So it is very significant.
Gracious. So you, how about, if you will, maybe just give us an overview. So I did an interview with someone the other day, and we were he does mobile imaging. So all of his stuff has to be transferred, you know, digitally, or, you know, we talked about some different things there. How about you give us just kind of a very layman's terms overview of how our images make it from one spot to the other spot?
Well, unfortunately, still the primary format of exchanging information is still on CDs, probably 90% of it.
Interesting.
So it's really the last vestige of CDs. Don't people use them for music, storing files, marketing? You don't get them in the mail anymore. You can't buy a laptop with a CD player on it anymore. And so this is really the last stop for that industry. But the reason why it still occurs is because it's still compliant. So faxing is also still compliant.
Oh,
although
wow.
Have information sitting out on a fax machine that anyone can walk by and read, they kind of get, these old technologies kind of get grandfathered in. And then moving forward, using these different exchanges, you have the technological hurdles, and then you have the security hurdles, but then ultimately the site has to feel they're safe and that they're compliant. And it's not completely understood yet what's compliant and what's non-compliant in electronic exchange, and so, and who's responsible for the data. So there's a lot of issues there. And so if you're looking at mobile, they're still generally burning on CDs and handing that off, or taking a hard drive or some type of portable media into a facility to load it onto a server.
So next what we're going to do is work through what you called like 10 pain points in this area of being able to transmit things safely and efficiently, effectively. And so I wanted to start with, and it's something you alluded to right there in that last answer, was about the safety of it. And so your very first pain point is about security and HIPAA. And you mentioned that, you know, there was a facility near you that was fined, a very large fine, just for losing a laptop, which I assume had lots of data on it. So let's talk a little bit about security, HIPAA, what it is we're protecting, and what happens when it gets breached.
Sure. So it's protecting the what they call PHI, protected healthcare information. And there's a lot of data, more data in healthcare information than any other data. So when you hear about Target being breached, they're stealing some financial data and your name and address. Well, with healthcare, there's a lot more than that. Generally, you can have even spousal information, kids' information. Social security numbers, financial data, your insurance data. There's a lot more. So that's why healthcare is now the number one target of hackers, because there's just more information to get. And what's really interesting in imaging is that every single radiology image has the metadata attached to it, called DICOM header information, which has your name. It can have a lot of details just within that. So you don't necessarily have to have a report and the data stored in their financial systems. There's a lot of data in every single image, so that has to be highly protected.
So I kind of have to two questions out of that. Well, I guess two statements out of that. One, there was a facility not too far from me, a couple hours out, that was, you know, kind of taken hostage, where they had to pay this ransom because their entire, you know, system had gotten hacked. So I wanted to ask you about that. And then the second thing was, I think I assumed that if images were hacked or you were trying to protect HIPAA, that even though there was basic information there, I also assumed you were trying to protect that patient's images. So really, what are you also saying, that it's the personal information that hackers are after?
Yeah,
that's or anybody, anybody that may come into contact with that information.
Right, that's what they're really after. Years ago, when this came about, a lot of it had to do with protecting that information from insurance companies. So they couldn't basically do a data scan on you and say, okay, you're high risk and charge higher rates. But now that's not as much of the concern as just getting the personal data for, you know, creating fake identities and you know, creating credit on someone else's name.
So is that the same basis for, like I said, when they shut down the entire facility because there was a ransom asked, you know, because somebody had taken control of their EMR or whatever?
Well, that's a whole different scam.
Okay. Okay, we won't get into all of that then today. So, like I said, I just found it kind of interesting that they're after personal data for things that have nothing to do with medicine sometimes. So that's an interesting, kind of an interesting concept. So your second pain point is speed. And so, especially since you said that so many things are still done on CD, which I wouldn't think would be very speedy, how does the process of like a virtual transfer, how does that change for providers and for patients? How does that change the way things are done?
Well, if you look at, let's say, the most critical use case or mission is trauma situations. So typical protocol, if they're going to move a patient by air, they are waiting for a CD to be burned. And it's typical protocol to tape it to the chest or put it under the left butt cheek. That's common practice. But literally, a helicopter can be waiting. And then the bad part is the CD can go with, and there's a chance that where it's going to, they can't read it. It has some type of issue, and there's numerous reasons why images can't be restored. Then that patient is sent back to radiology for a CT or whatever type of procedure they may need, and patients die because of this. So there's speed in that element of just, you know, a trauma case. But then if you're looking at typical use case situations, getting speed to care. So if there's something wrong with the patient, getting them to the right specialist to make sure their images and information are there, and improve just the speed to care, getting them admitted for, you know, let's say it's leukemia or something like that where they need to get immediate treatment.
So the third thing you bring up is like ease of use or features. And for any of us in medicine, you know, the more complicated things get, the more complicated things get. And so, you know, we've all got pieces of equipment that have more bells and whistles on them than ever. Some of those are very much for the good. Some of those just tend to get in the way. So how important is it that you're able to easily, you know, transfer these images so that, like you mentioned, sometimes on the other end something happens, but so that both end users, you know, can get what they need out of it?
Yeah, there's, you know, typically the people handling these transfers of images are rad techs, you know, hourly type employees, and there's turnover rates. So you can't get into lengthy training of how to move data around. So it should be something that's intuitive. They walk up to it, can get the patient information, and then send it very quickly. And we can do that with a few clicks. And we like to say that a lot of the magic is happening behind the curtain. So complex things are going on without the user having to do anything with it. So that cleaning up of the data, regardless of which OEM it comes from, GE, Siemens, Philips, we don't really care. We make sure it goes into a universal format then, so that when it is received into any other OEM system, they can restore that data and not have to, there's situations where they manually edit tags and things like that to try to get the data restored, and they don't have to do that with our system.
So I'm going to your fourth point, and kind of backwards to that third point about ease of use, and then the fourth point is about flexibility. I know lots of departments, probably every department, is so busy right now. And like you said, there's turnover. You know, people are coming and going. There are different shifts. And then people are just busy in the business of taking care of patients. So to add anything else into their day, even though it's something that's, you know, very needed, is legally binding, is, you know, for the greater good of patient care, just to add just one more thing into those days sometimes can be traumatizing, sometimes can be overwhelming. So you talk about, we just talked about ease of use and the features. What about implementation? What about when you bring this into a facility? How easy is that to use? How does it fit into that already very busy workflow so that you're making it easy or making it simple and efficient for the people that are actually performing these functions?
Yeah, those are all critical issues. Like I said, the training thing, you have to avoid that so they can walk up to it and do what they need to get done, complex problems. And some of that flexibility that we talk about is being able to use any type of image format. So DICOM is the language protocol of radiology, but not all images are in that format.
Okay.
So you can take any format, JPEG, TIFF, GIF, and also convert that to DICOM without them having to go through some complex process. It just converts it automatically. So we solve those problems. And as far as implementing it, the other thing that we reverse the polarity on is that they credential themselves into the system. So instead of an administrator having to manage their username and password, and this has been very effective for smaller facilities because they're usually dealing with a bunch of supporting people around the healthcare community, the surrounding from chiropractors, podiatrists, whoever it may be on any level of radiology, that they can credential themselves into the system, then share data with any of the other people within that system across the country, which is 3,500 locations or so now.
So a question, what kind of system do you have to have on both ends? So if you've got a system in your facility and you're trying to send to, what does the receiving system look like?
So anyone can register and then download the software at no cost. And so as a receiver, they just need that our client on any PC that they have on their network. And so it uses a standard email port, and then the only the receiver can decrypt that data. So when the sender is sending it, if you think of, a lot of people have compared it to PayPal. So if you think of PayPal, both people credential themselves into the system, and you're talking about sending money. So for people to be comfortable with that, it better be pretty secure. And so we use a lot of the same type of process and functionality as PayPal.
So do you have to have specific users on each end? I can't just send to some random person unless I know their name. So I guess is my question. So
right.
Do users on each end have to be part of the system?
Yes.
Like PayPal?
Yep. Yeah, both people have to be registered into the system.
Okay. That makes sense, Dewey. And so you mentioned credentialing, how people set up their own credentials in there, you know, so you don't have one admin managing everything for everybody. Why is that a good idea? And then how does that work for the user that's trying to, you know, work on either end of the system?
Yeah, well, it can work both ways. So your major institutions, they do have their own login systems, usually what's called LDAP or AD, Active Directory. And so that's set up for their domain that they can control those users to be able to log in or log out, or if they leave the facility in just one shot, they can make sure they can't log into any systems. So we integrate with those as well, so they can have a single account for that facility, and then all the logins work inside that institution. But as far as sender, recipient, someone has to initialize that initial registration and credentialing. So with the institutions, there's probably 1,000 institutions, and then you have 2,500 practices or small clinics that are registered in. So total users could be, you know, a multitude of that within an institution itself.
So your number six point is about universal formatting, and you talked about DICOM. First, I want to ask you a little bit of history on DICOM. When did that, what does that mean? You know, since this is an educational program, we're going to educate everybody. What does DICOM mean? And how did that come about that became the universal language for radiology?
DICOM, it stands for Digital Imaging Communication and Medicine. And that came about as a standard from NEMA, which is kind of strange, which is a North American Electronics Manufacturers Association.
Okay.
There was all these different formats in radiology, and there was analog systems, and then the digital system sort of come out, and how could you communicate and store this data in a single repository? And so, and then there's attributes within the images. And so this DICON protocol has a couple of different elements to it. One is within the image data itself, there's values and things that are recorded within that data. So when it goes to another system, it's viewed the way the original acquisition device or that technologist intended the doctor or radiologist to see it. So there's DICOM values that mean or represent contrast levels and lumen levels and different types of grayscales and stuff like that. And then the other part of it is network protocols. So you have different tiers within a network. So you have your IP level, the port level, and then the application level. And so with different systems, they can find each other on that network. So I want to send something to a workstation for a radiologist to review. I can find that on the network and send it directly to that system. And so these protocols became very important to make sure this data could be moved around. And what's great, it's really the only global standard as far as medical data goes. In EMRs, it's what they call HL7, which hasn't done nearly as well as DICOM has in imaging.
So you said earlier that the system, your system to transfer images can read any format, you know, that it's flexible in that it can, you know, pick up any of those different formats. You mentioned JPEGs and things like that. So one, explain that a little bit. And then why are there still some facilities that are using, why are there still some facilities using CDs, but why are there so many different formats? Maybe that's the question I'm trying to ask.
Well, there's a bunch of reasons for the formats. Some is it's just what that system is using for their native format. So like there's surgery recorders that just record MP4. And so we can convert that MP4 to DICOM so they can store it then in the hospital storage systems. And then there's some of it was about saving space. So DICOM images can be rather large. A study, let's say that's 50 megabytes, if it was in JPEGs, might be 5 megabytes.
Gotcha.
So a JPEG can be viewed and can be very clear, but doesn't have those DICOM attributes assigned to it for the window leveling and the contrast and so forth. So yeah, there's PACS companies trying to save space by having different formats and even proprietary formats. And we correct all those and make them in universal DICOM so they can be universally shared and viewed.
I would think that a proprietary format would be very binding, that obviously there's not a, it's difficult for universal use. So that seems like an odd way to go about, you know, developing a system.
Well, yeah, then a lot of that has to do with trying to control the environment. So if I pick on, let's say GE, they'll do certain things in their system because then they can tell the hospital, well, yeah, if, don't worry about it working in Siemens or Philips or whatever, just buy all GE and it'll work. And so they'll just do enough to screw it up, just enough to say, it's if you stick with all GE, you'll be fine. Don't go with any other you know, suppliers or OEMs. So that's our view of it, is controlling the environment.
Understood. On the they do just enough to it that you kind of get stuck with that system. So yeah. Okay, that makes sense to me too. You talked about patient data being a part of EMR. And so how does your system work with all of, with the different EMRs, because there are, you know, a couple of big ones there, but how does yours work with all the different systems inside of a system?
Well, so the EMRs are, their language protocol is HL7, and that's generally all text data, so not image data. And so that's where your, you know, from financial information, pharma information, scheduling, prior appointments, all that kind of stuff is kept in the EMR, but also the reports are. So when a radiologist reads a report, generally that information, his diagnosis, prognosis is kept in the EMR. And so those text file data, we can receive those in a few different ways, whether it's an HL7 output or we're querying the data and pulling it back into our system. And then we will also put that in universal format. And generally, if we're going to display it off the CD or in the cloud, it's just an HTML5. So that's a universal viewing capability as well.
So I'm going to go on to your next point, and you talked about support, and I believe that support on all ends. So we had a little bit of a discussion about workplace conditions and how busy, you know, how busy facilities are, how sometimes difficult it is to implement new things. Why is it important to have support from a vendor that's providing the service, and what does that support look like?
Well, we have techs on staff that can log in, you know, any time of the day. So if there is some kind of problem, they generally take control, can view that screen wherever that institution or site is at, and then help them solve whatever problem they're trying to solve immediately. So that support gives them a lot of confidence in using our system to say, we know we can always call in and get somebody on the phone to fix this problem. It's really interesting. Our systems don't cost much money, but they're so mission critical. If they're down, something's not working, it becomes, you think it was their $5 million CT machine that just went down. But we play such a major role in moving that data around, and they become dependent on us.
So I think that was something important that you just said. You said that, if you know, we're not big, but we're mission critical. What does it look like for a facility if their ability to transfer images isn't working? What does that mean to that facility?
It can mean a lot of things. I mean, in worst case levels is losing a patient. Those are serious situations. Like I mentioned earlier, trauma cases. We always look at it from that speed to care element too. Right. That let's get, if that patient's there at the site and it's there, there's going to be some diagnosis and then they need care right away, why should that be delayed? That also lowers cost ultimately as well, because you're not having second appointments, unnecessary rescans. Upwards of 20% of radiology procedures are exact duplicate unnecessary rescans, which cost billions of dollars to the healthcare costs in the U.S.
Interesting. Because I know there have been lots of articles done and different reports and all talking about the increase in radiology procedures being ordered, you know, especially maybe like in an emergency room situation where it seems that everybody that comes in the door is getting something just, you know, because. So it's interesting that you said there's the big cost and just the quantity that are rescans for whatever reason.
Yeah, so we walk on that razor's edge of that debate because, of course, we believe radiology is the best tool in medicine. I mean, taking a look inside is always better than, you know, just palpating or listening from the outside. Stethoscopes will be a thing of the past. I mean, they're already fading away, but new doctors don't even consider them. They have these little portable ultrasounds, and so instead of listening to the lungs, they can take a quick look, or the heart as well. Mm-hmm. And get a lot more information. So we're all for that, but when it becomes unnecessary rescans or when equipment is not calibrated properly, let's say you have a 250-pound man in a CT machine and then a 60-pound child coming right after, if that's not recalibrated, they're overdosed. And so 2-3% of leukemia cases in the U.S. are considered CT-induced. And then if you look at that as an expensive healthcare cost, that's, you know, again, it's hard to put a figure on it, but I'm sure it's in the many, many millions.
What was that percentage you said? What percentage of leukemia cases could be CT induced?
2-3%. It's
estimated. 2-3%.
Yeah.
Yes, and I, especially with the increased use of CT, You know, and just knowing the etiological factors of different cancers. So that makes sense. I just want to make sure I got that percentage correct. Yeah, so one of your other pain points was the health information exchange. So do you mind explaining to us what that is, what that acronym HIE, you know, what it stands for and what that all means? And then we'll break that down into some of the different, you know, programmatic kind of features.
Well, health information exchange is it's a great idea. It's a very popular idea. Unfortunately, most of them are state funded, and so they're not well supported, and the technology in most cases isn't great, and they're not really communicating well with each other. And ultimately, what it comes down to from our point of view is everyone's been to the DMV and the post office, and in most cases, not many people care that you're standing there waiting in line. So you start to get into, you know, these mission critical issues again, trying to get data. And if you can't get it out, who are you going to call? I know I wouldn't want to call the state of Illinois and be sitting on hold waiting to see what images or not. So I think ultimately, if you're looking at the, you know, the social conscious of healthcare, which is what was driving these HIEs, is that the players that will emerge are the good providers that solve these technological problems and then do it at a low enough cost that the institutions and even independent users will say that's worth the value.
So I'm going to ask you some questions here that you have listed kind of in this article that we've been working through. You said, and we talked a little bit about mobile before, because I had, you know, just spoken to a mobile technologist. So one of your questions is mobile secure, and who and what is at risk from this exchange of information?
Well, mobile, it just depends on what they're using to move that data. One of the methods in mobile is using cellular, and cellular by default is very well encrypted. And so that is okay to use. We also offer a cellular bonding technology where you can grab multiple service providers at the same time. So the this HD integrity is not lost in moving the data or even communicating through our telehealth platform. We can use cellular bonding. But so that's good if they're using that. If they're using CDs, not so secure, but still very compliant. And I'll explain one thing about the CDs as well, why it's still so popular and so compliant. Because HIPAA, most people don't understand that actually responsibility sits on both sides of that fence, the provider and the recipient. Okay. So if I hand somebody a CD, I have clean hands. So I'm the hospital, I hand it to the patient. Now, whatever they do with it, if they lose it or it accidentally ends up in someone else's hands, not my problem now, because I gave it to them. That's another advantage with our peer-to-peer network. Instead of it being hosted in the cloud, where that responsibility essentially gets straddled, in a peer-to-peer, once it's sent and confirmed, you have clean hands with that too. So I think that helps drive some of the compliance issues.
Okay, this is this is pretty far off topic, but since you brought up the two, you know, two sides to that coin, once something's handed off, then the, you know, hospital can kind of wipe their hand, you know, wash their hands with the whole HIPAA thing. With the advent of social media and the ridiculous growth that it, you know, that it's experienced, and you see people put stuff out on their own stuff. I'm talking about personal stuff. I'm not talking about professionals sharing things that they shouldn't be sharing. I'm talking about patients who are putting their own stuff out there. So then the hospital's free and done with that, or the facility's done with that, because that was shared by the patient, correct?
Yes. As soon as the patient initiates anything, all HIPAA's out the window.
Okay. It's all out the window and onto Facebook, huh?
Right. Well, we provide a product called BabyView that gets keepsake ultrasounds to mom. So as we've been radiology experts for a long time, we kept getting asked that question. If you can deliver images, can you figure out a compliant way to deliver mom's keepsake ultrasounds? And so we developed a platform where we're using our technology but repurposed in a consumer-driven way to... After mom has her clinical ultrasound, we work transparently in the background automatically take out the pathology, and then they get a CINE clip, and it's down converted to an MP4, so it has no diagnostic value. And then they can share it on Facebook and that stuff, and that's one of the things they really want to share. For obvious reasons, it's a
just as long as nobody starts sharing like gallbladder ultrasounds, we'll be okay, huh?
No, but there is the what do they call it, survivor's pride. Uh-huh. People do share, you know, surviving a big tumor and the image of it getting removed, or a badly broken leg from skiing and all the screws in it, because look what I survived. And there's actually companies that will make molds of your you know, bone structure, and yeah, it's a crazy business out there.
That is a little crazy. That is a little crazy. One of your other questions is, how secure is all of this data when we're having backups and when the, you know, when stuff's churning around every day? How secure is that, and what's that data integrity look like?
It just depends on how it's being kept. Most hospitals still have their own servers, and they're keeping that data on site. And then they're generally backing it up somewhere. But I think that will all change within the next 10 years, that there won't be any on-site data anymore. It'll all be kept in the cloud, and companies like GE and Siemens, Philips, McKesson that provide these storage systems now will not be in that business. It'll be managed by what is perceived to be security businesses, because that will be their whole mantra, that we're the most secure. And that could be Amazon, Google, or Microsoft, but it'll be in some type of, you know, health vault that they say is supremely secure.
I was about, before you mentioned it, I was going to say, is this where an Amazon or a Google comes into play? What would that look like?
Well, we use Google for our storage, and so each user's account is their own encryption. It's unique to them. And then each study has its own encryption, so it makes it a very bad target for hackers.
Right.
But yeah, if it is stored in a single repository, which are companies that do that, and then you just have to get past the one wall to have access to everything, it's not a matter of if, it's when they get hacked. And those are, anyone should be very concerned about that. And then who is responsible for that is the other question. So I think going forward, there's going to be more patient responsibility, and patients will want that responsibility, choosing where they store their health data and possibly even paying for it to be more secure.
So interestingly that you said that about patient responsibility, especially with the new transparency legislation, you know, that's recently been discussed and passed and talked about quite a bit. It seems that patients are seeking more ways to be responsible. So like with the transparency things, they're wanting to know what things cost, you know, as a consumer before they have tests done or hospital stays or whatever. What do you think patients or consumers feel about Google or Amazon entering this space? Do you think they feel more secure just because of the history of Google and Amazon, and maybe they trust them a little more? What are your thoughts on that, on patients seeking out information and making maybe more informed decisions?
Yeah, I think it'll be, they won't mind if they're the provider, but there has to be some intermediary company like Nautilus or other companies that's saying, yeah, we use Google Secure Storage, but they want to know that Google doesn't have access to that data to mine information. And so as a provider, they don't have that access. But when they were trying to do Google Health, and Microsoft had, I can't remember what theirs was called, but they failed because, yeah, you're right, they were not trusted. Like, okay, they're going to just take the data, and both those companies lost a few billion dollars trying to promote that. And now they've realized we're better off going out and getting partners. That's how we ended up with Google. They sought us out and said, hey, can we be a provider for you? And we also use Amazon as well. And I think they're all very secure, but no one wants to just give their data directly to them.
So one of your final points is about cost. And so I think cost is kind of twofold as well. Like cost, like what does it cost you? But what could the cost be to you if a facility doesn't invest in these types of security measures and in something that just works really well. So not to ask about specific cost, but you said it was kind of it wasn't a big ticket, item sort of thing. But what can the cost to a facility be without these measures in place?
Well, if they don't have the security, a breach can be in the millions of dollars, and they can actually be fined per record, $50,000 per record. So you lose 1,000 records, it adds up rather quickly.
Wow, yeah.
And then HIPAA is criminal prosecution. So what that means is that the individual is responsible. So they could be looking at jail time for something that's egregious, or if they intentionally took data to sell it, that would be something that would be considered a criminal act then. So on that end, the cost can be very significant. On the other end, they're spending a tremendous amount of money for storage and security systems and having compliance officers, security risk officers, and that's a tremendous expense. So I think they can farm all that out to companies like ours in the very near future and just depend on storage and security providers like us. And that cost is significantly less because storage keeps getting less and less expensive.
Right.
There's compression techniques to keep that cost even lower. And just if you look at electronic exchange compared to a CD, we've done studies on the cost of CDs from the hardware to the time invested. And then that's not even including ancillary costs if they get sued from losing a patient or something like that. It's a fraction of the cost. So even if it was a dollar to exchange a patient, it's typically a CD on average costs the hospital around $14 per disc.
Oh, wow. That's interesting that y'all taken the time to look into all, to study how that data got collected and what that path of CD is. So that's interesting that you say a CD, a CD containing images is about $14 per patient cost to facility. So I want to ask you one last question, and that is, what do you find? You said you kind of evolved into this, even though you've been in this space a long time now, you kind of got here. What do you find to be the most rewarding in this safety and security, and like you said, the ability to transfer maybe life-saving types of images? What do you find to be most rewarding in all of this? Is it the technology of it or patient care aspect of it, or what?
Well, all of that. We strive to build the best technology. You get feedback and stories. We've had some interesting ones over the years. One day, Cleveland Clinic called in a panic. They needed to move a 2 gigabyte cardiology study down to Southern Ohio Medical Center. And so we know this exists on the system. How do we do it? And we said, okay, we'll call Southern Ohio Medical Center. We got them registered and on, and we moved. By the time that first phone call took place, and moving such a large study from start to finish was 15 minutes.
Oh, wow.
It saved that patient's life. And so to hear those stories is great. It's you start to realize you're having an impact on healthcare and people's lives, which is becomes your motivator every day. Because people say, how can you do this every day? And knowing that you're having real impact out there is very rewarding.
Well, thank you, Tim, so much. One, I love that story. I love how you can combine technology and, still have that motivating driver of patient care, and that you have real stories, that kind of back that up for you and make you smile, because you smiled a lot when you told that story. So thanks a lot. I've learned a whole lot. I learned a lot about HIPAA and, about posting your ultrasounds on Facebook and just how images are transferred. And this works really well, considering that I'd just spoken to the mobile technologist and how he transferred those images. So thanks a bunch for this interview. I've really enjoyed it.
All right. Thanks, Cheryl. Appreciate the time.